Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
I think I'm seeing the same athletes today as I saw 4 years ago, running a minute and a half faster. It's almost an athletics equivalent of the Me Too movement. And they're not reacting like this because of carnitine and a testosterone experiment, where they're going to test various amounts of testosterone on Salazar's sons. Said that Salazar prioritizes performance well beyond the health of his athletes.
It's been called the craziest week in athletics. Well, that's what we're calling it here at the Science of Sport podcast. An amazing week of both good and bad stuff in the world of track and field. And we're going to be wrapping up a little bit of the World Athletics Championships, which is happening in Doha at the moment, but also talking a little bit about the run by Kenenisa Bekele in Berlin just over 5 days ago. And of course, the big story that's broken in athletics this week, of course, is the case of Alberto Salazar. And we've had quite a few requests from our Twitter followers and all of those that interact with us on Twitter to do a podcast on this. And we'll be doing a little bit of analysis, first of all, what the case involves and all the different sentiments that have come away from that particular incident. So there's lots to talk about in this podcast. Let's start off with the good stuff, though. And Ross, thanks so much for joining us again. Of course, Professor Ross Tucker, my regular co-host on this show. Let's start off with the good stuff. Kenenisa Bekele's run in Berlin, 2:01:40, 41. His second fastest time in history. Not bad for a 37-year-old.
Yeah, not bad for anyone, I suppose, because, you know, that world record is 2:01:39. So the context of 2:01:41 is that it's 2 seconds over 42 kilometers slower than the world record.
Yeah.
And you'll recall that when the world record was 2:02:57, Bekele ran 2:03:03. So cumulatively, he's run twice in Berlin and missed the world record by a total of 8 seconds. So, and then you think, well, surely you can find 2 seconds somewhere. And I don't know how many people watched that race, but it was quite remarkable and surprising, because I don't think anyone expected a time that would actually challenge a world record that a year ago people were saying was untouchable.
Yeah.
But we're clearly in a new generation or new era of marathon running, and I think there's an important conversation that needs to be had around what's driving that now, because when you go to the world all-time lists and you look at course records, you look at national records, they are falling at a rate that you would not have predicted. Yeah. And they have one thing in common. We'll get to that. But yeah, the performance was amazing, because he went through halfway slightly slower than Kipchoge in his world record. Kipchoge ran a massive negative split in 2018. He finished in 60:33. So watching it, I thought, well, that's pretty aggressive. They're doing exactly what they said they'd do. But it's likely to just not fizzle out, but a mid 2:02 looks good. And then he got dropped. The youngster Legesse actually put in an almighty surge at 30K, ran a 14:09 segment, and Bekele was gapped.
Yeah.
And it looked like, here we go, same old story.
That's right.
And I was tracking the splits at the time, and when that 14:09 came up, I remember thinking, well, Bekele's now conceded 13 seconds. And so he actually hasn't slowed down. This damage you've seen here is exclusively from one guy who's made an incredible move at the front. So if Bekele can just hang on to this, maybe he can still catch up. But then he sped up.
Yeah.
And so Bekele, I drew this graph. People can find it on my Twitter account, on the feed from a week ago. And he gets progressively faster and faster by more or less the same. And it's this perfectly straight line. And he runs, I think, 14:20, 14:15, and suddenly at 40Ks, he's 2 seconds under world record pace.
Yeah.
Now it's on. But
was he under at one point? I didn't realize he was ever under world.
He was 2 seconds quicker with 2Ks to go. And the difference eventually is that Kipchoge finished 4 seconds faster over the final 2:195, and that made the difference. So he was actually on course to break that world record at 40Ks, and no one really realized it.
Yeah.
Because it was so unexpected.
I think what was really surprising about it is everybody was watching this race, and when you normally see the Kipchoge train going, it's all about pace setters and they've set a certain time, they go through certain splits. But this was a proper race, and I actually remember tweeting it on my Twitter feed saying, thank goodness it was a world record. But in fact, it was a proper race and a world record that was almost, well, no, I'm not saying it was a world record, but it was a very fast time in a race situation rather than just a paced world record, which we've seen from Kipchoge in the last couple of years.
You mean Bekele's one now?
Yes, it was more of a race than it was just a paced event.
Yeah, Kipchoge was on his own from like 25K. So he ran the last 17 as a time trial.
Yeah.
Which probably tells you that he did have a bit more in the tank. Looking at it now, Legesse goes 14:21, 14:09 from 25 to 35 Ks. Unbelievably quick 10. And that's what creates the gap. But Bekele, meanwhile, has gone from 20 to 25, 14:32, 14:25, 14:20, 14:15. And then he runs the last two at 14:05 pace.
Yeah.
Problem is Kipchoge ran at 13:58 pace. And that did for him. So, like, unbelievable comeback because Bekele gets written off.
Yeah.
I mean, the race itself was a microcosm of Bekele's career. Aggressive, looking good, gapped, disappointing. Maybe next time. Actually, there he comes back. That's kind of how the last 4 or 5 years have gone for him.
Yeah.
But at 37, to be running like that, it's remarkable. And again, Legesse in second is running sub 2:03.
Yeah. And it was almost forgotten man.
Exactly. I mean, forgotten at the start line and then prominent because he's gapped the greatest of all time and then forgotten at the finish. But he's still in the top five in history. Yeah. So, it was an unbelievable race.
So, let's talk about, I mean, we're obviously going to be doing a separate pod on this, but there is one common denominator with all of these performances that we've seen over the last year or so, and that is this Nike shoe that we've talked a little bit about in past podcasts. There is some controversy about it. There's people saying it should be banned because essentially it is proven to be an advantage. There are those that say that every shoe that you wear is an advantage to some extent.
Yeah.
Just give us a bit of a pricey about where the shoe sits in your mind as a sports scientist, and is it the determining factor now, or are there lots of other things?
I think to the last question, I think that it is the determining factor now because I think that it gives athletes an advantage that is large enough. I can't put a finger on what that number is, but I think that it's large enough that it distorts our understanding of whether we're seeing performance integrity.
Yeah.
And as you say, we'll do a whole podcast of this in the lead up to the sub 2 attempt in Vienna because it's in my opinion, central to that.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. When you see a guy run 2:03 in a marathon, unbelievable, physiologically constrained performance, because you ask, why did he not go quicker? And the reason he doesn't go quicker is because his physiology limits him. He can't get sufficient oxygen and energy to the muscles to power that performance for that long.
Yeah.
So there's a ceiling that is imposed by physiology. I think that what the shoe is doing is allowing the athlete to sidestep those physiological limits. And the end result is that the same physiological input is producing a faster performance.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the case for other shoes. It could be for some to small degrees. But what the lab testing on this particular shoe, the Vaporfly, initially 4%, now it's called Next Percent because they think they've made it even better. The 4% was tested, admittedly funded by Nike, so take what you want from conflicts of interest. And they put a bunch of guys in a lab, and they were reasonably good runners, not Kipchoge, Bekele level, and they measure oxygen consumption as a way to work out how much energy is used to run a certain speed. And on average, you use 4% less energy to run 3 minutes a K, whatever speed they test. They tested it at three different speeds. Now, if you can run the same speed using less energy, and energy was the thing that limited you, then you can run with the same energy at a faster speed. That's logical, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not necessarily in a one-to-one relationship. So a 4% drop in oxygen and energy doesn't translate to a 4% faster speed. It's a little bit less than that for the top guys.
Yeah.
But in theory, 2.6% is what they think it's worth. A 4% oxygen saving translates to 2.6% performance benefits.
Which is a huge performance benefit at that level of the sport.
Well, at any level. Because over a 2-hour-3 marathon, 2.6% is 3 minutes. Now, I don't think that the shoe's worth that much. I think there's a little bit of marketing as well.
Yeah.
But two things for me is, number one, that initial study on the shoe was then not precisely replicated, but it was subsequently followed up by other research. No study has yet found an athlete who doesn't respond to that shoe.
Yeah.
So in other words, there's no non-responders, and that's unique because everything else, whether it's creatine that you take as a powder, whether it's a different shoe, for the Adidas Boost, for example, in the past, they found this 1% increase in economy or improvement, but there were responders and non-responders. There are none to this shoe.
Yeah.
So I think the effect is real, and I think the effect is large enough that I don't know what I'm watching. Because if the theoretical advantage is 2.6, then even if you go one third of that, you're at 0.9.
Yeah.
And a 0.9% benefit is 1 minute.
Yeah.
So take Kipchoge, take Bekele, take Legesse, and add a minute to their times. It's the same as 2014, 2015. Sure. So what we've seen is a minute to a minute and a half improvement in times created by nothing other than distorting that relationship between input and output.
Yeah.
So I think I'm seeing the same athlete today as I saw 4 years ago running a minute and a half faster. Yeah. And how do I interpret that? Because people come and they say, oh, but Roger Bannister ran on a cinder tracks. Who cares about Bannister? That was 1954. Nobody has ever debated whether Bannister or Algarouz is going to win in a race.
Yeah.
It's like Federer versus Laver. Who cares? Maybe if we have 10 beers, we can have that debate. That's a stupid debate to me.
I suppose the thing is that people go that any kind of technology that is out there is going to be used to an advantage of the athlete. So whether you're wearing a pair of Adidas Ultra Boost shoes, for instance, that supposedly gives some sort of energy return back to the athlete, there is some advantage. It's better than running in a shoe that doesn't have that, theoretically. If a shoe is more comfortable, if the lacing system is better, if it's more durable, if it has more grip on the sole, it's better than barefoot. So to what extent, and this is why this debate, and this is why we're going to be looking at a podcast on this a bit later on, but to what extent is an advantage in terms of technology like a shoe?
So that's a philosophical question, and I promise
I like
you,
those.
Please see my laptop here. Please see my phone and my sophisticated. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not living in some cave, dark ages by candlelight. I'm not opposed to technology.
Yeah.
But what bothers me is that of all the sports, running is in theory the one where you're matching physiology against physiology.
Yeah.
And I want to see the best runner, the guy who's got the physiological capacity, the running economy, the VO2 max, the efficiency, the threshold, the muscle tendon function, whatever it is. Take your pick of what determines that performance. It's lots of things. But I want to see that guy win in a race today. Yeah. I don't care about Jim Peters running 2:15 versus Kipchoge running 2:01. I care about Kipchoge against his contemporaries.
Yeah.
And when we start talking about world records, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
Now, again, 2:15, we've moved on so far from that period that it's actually not even a direct comparison. Nobody is writing the headline, Bekele 14 minutes faster than Jim Peters. No one cares.
Yeah.
But they do care that Bekele is a minute and a half faster than Kometa from 4 years back. Because that's within one generation. So is that technology available to all? And does it have a large enough difference in those people who have access to it, that it actually distorts the outcome of the result? Swimsuits did that.
But I mean, all athletes have access to that shoe. I mean, they might not be sponsored by Nike, but I mean, to be honest with you, if that's their decision, whether they want to be sponsored by an alternative brand. So if everybody, you can buy those shoes freely, anybody can buy that shoe now. So is that not the determinant? So if everybody can buy that shoe and it's freely available, surely then everybody should run in it and everybody should be equal.
Again, philosophically and in theory, the shoe is not freely available that the top elites are using. So they're customizing it and tuning it and optimizing it for the guys. So they warm up in the commercially available shoe and then they change over to something else. That was revealed at the London Marathon. So there was a bit of discussion about that. It's actually engineering per athlete now. Whether that
You're saying individual shoes are different from the stock one you can buy potentially online.
So I'm saying, is that no one else can get that shoe that those guys are racing in.
Okay.
So then in that regard, that argument is almost moot. But even if you could, it still wouldn't sit well with me because there's a commercial model that underpins the sport.
Yeah.
And if everyone does that, I mean, prior to the 2008 Olympics, when it became apparent that the swimsuit, the LZR racer, was so effective, athletes who were sponsored by other companies binned it, their own suits. They said, sorry, guys, this is my life's work at the Olympic Games. I can't take the risk. And so then those sponsors take a hit. And in this regard, let's be very clear, Nike have made a breakthrough, which other companies had been looking for. So over a decade, 15 years ago now maybe, other companies have tried to put a carbon fiber plate in a shoe to return energy and so forth and do exactly what's been done, and they couldn't get it right.
Yeah.
We'll discuss why in our specific podcast. But so the breakthrough is a technological one, and it's actually then put Nike's rivals behind it. Because that's exactly what's happening. At the Dubai Marathon, I can't remember if it was this year or last, one of the guys was sponsored by Adi. He ran in a Nike shoe and tried to paint the Adidas logo over his shoe. So he had this like drawn in pen or paint or something, three stripes over the swoosh. Because that's what they'll do. So that's a commercial argument. I'm not a big fan of stopping people from like progressing something based on innovation. But again, I want to watch sport for its not any sport, but running in specific, for its physiological purity. And that's a purity with a quotation marks, because we'll get to why maybe it's not so pure in a moment. But this shoe for me undermines the integrity of it. And they should have had a policy that just limits the addition of midsole devices and limits the stack height of the shoe. Because then you can't do what they're doing. Now, they're arguing that it's the foam that's returning the energy and that the carbon fiber plate helps with what they're calling geometry. Their initial patent was all about carbon fiber spring. I think they've probably discovered for themselves that it's not a spring. But I just think the regulation of this is so easy.
Yeah.
And it has changed marathon running. So people say greatest runners in history, Kipchoge and Bekele. Well, yeah, but
yeah.
How? I don't know how to contextualize what I'm watching.
Well, it is certainly a very interesting subject, and we're going to be focusing on that particular shoe around the sub-2 hour marathon challenge later on, in a couple of weeks' time, actually, from now. So we'll be discussing that in more detail. But the big story this week, and I think to some extent, and maybe Ross, you'll agree with me on this, this is kind of the Lance Armstrong of athletics, the biggest story that I think in doping. And we talked about the Chinese in the early 90s and all those sort of things. But, you know, since then, this has probably one of the biggest stories in athletics. Alberto Salazar, the great American marathon runner and now coach of the Nike Oregon Project, banned for 4 years by USADA for a variety of different transgressions. And we'll get into some of the details on those. But it's a story that has rocked athletics and right in the middle of the World Championships, because the World Championships themselves, a lot of those athletes that have been participating are under his care. Some athletes have been reacting very positively to the news that finally the truth is out. Other athletes have defended him. And it's been quite, in a way, polarizing. We see Paula Radcliffe almost defending him, although there is obviously another reason for her doing that, because she is connected to him via various people. But it is a very emotive one, because even now, Nike are defending him, but the evidence seems fairly clear.
Yeah, but Nike has to defend him, because if they didn't, they'd be confessing guilt. Because it's really important to appreciate that by this verdict implicates Nike in at least knowing about what was being done. So there is, in the USADA verdict, there is an email exchange between the CEO, not head of running, head of sponsorship, athlete liaison, the CEO, and the doctor, who's also been found guilty of doping violations in this arbitration process, and Salazar discussing one of the things that he's been sanctioned for, namely the testosterone experiment. So my read of that is that if Nike were to abandon him, it would be a confession of guilt, in a sense, or an admission at least that they knew and didn't intervene. So everyone has to fight together. It's all, you know, stand as one kind of thing. Divided we fall, and or united we stand, divided we fall kind of thing. So that doesn't surprise me too much. I think there are some bigger questions about the corporate factors driving that. I was listening to the Let's Run podcast, and they made a really good point that Salazar has been flying close to the wind, or too close to the sun, for years. And why was he doing that? He was enabled to do that by the corporate culture and the money and the resources that Nike provided. So I don't think that one can divorce those two things. And subsequently, I have seen, and I think one of the most interesting things that will happen as a result of this is that media and athletes will now find a voice that they previously were holding back. So, for example, I just want to read you what Nick Willis tweeted. And Nick Willis is an Olympic medalist. He's one of the great runners. He comes across to me as a guy who has unbelievable integrity. And he posts the following in the aftermath of the decision. He says, justice. I'm tired of having to hide my thoughts. The charade is finally over. Our sport will be much better off with Alberto gone. I mean, how strong is that? Yeah. From a current guy running. And for me, what's telling is I'm tired of having to hide my thoughts.
Yeah.
So I've had thoughts and I've had to suppress them. And now I don't need to anymore. And how many other athletes might that be? There might be dozens who now say, it's almost an athletics equivalent of the Me Too movement. Now suddenly you might start getting people. Lauren Fleshman was one of the people who's been named going back to 2015 as a person with Salazar. I think she was the one who told of how he would make them run up and down stairs to get out of breath and then go for an asthma test so that they'd fail it in order to get asthma meds.
Yeah.
And she posted a very thoughtful, thread on Twitter about we need to ask questions around the culture that enables this, that nobody at any point says no. Because the truth is, if anyone, Nike, UK Athletics, has been coming under major fire for letting their prized asset, Mo Farah, go to this guy while he was under investigation, if anyone was genuinely anti-doping, zero tolerance, this would never have come to this.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. So I think that for me, I'm like Willis, also tired of having to hold back. Because, 12, 15 years ago, I met with journalists, I'm not going to name exactly who they were, and started discussing the stuff that has only now come out this week officially. And there is so much more of it. This is tip of the iceberg stuff. Nick Willis isn't tired of having to hide his thoughts and saying the charade is over because of a carnitine and a testosterone experiment that Salazar did. There's more to this, much more.
So I've just got a clip up here. And for those of you watching us live on YouTube at the moment, you'll be able to see on our screen an interview that's on Twitter from, what's the guy's name who actually tweeted it? It was
Cathal Dennehy.
Cathal Dennehy.
Who, by the way, wrote also, because you don't do it because you're media, but I often criticize the media for how they softly handle these guys. When they do this sort of stuff, like Cathal, you got to give him some props. You got to say, well done, because he wrote a brilliant piece. And I want to read a quote from that at the end of what you play now as well.
Okay, so this is an interview with Jenny Simpson, a former world champion in the 1500 meters, I think in 2011. And she spoke very strongly about her feelings about the Salazar case. Let's see.
Get him out. That's my reaction. You cheat, you get banned. I don't believe our lifetime bans. I wish it was longer. Don't cheat.
Did you think, I mean, there's been allegations, but nothing was, no sanctions handed down until this week. I mean, what were your thoughts about him before? Were you skeptical? Did you think he should have been gone before?
I mean, anybody that knows any about this sport knows that there's a black shadow, black cloud, whatever the analogy you want to make, over that group. And so why anyone chooses to be a part of that group, I have no idea. Anyone that's shocked isn't involved in the sport.
Well, there we go. I mean, that's fairly definitive thoughts from Jenny Simpson saying that, she wants him out. He was in a way, a cancer for the sport. So she feels very strongly about that.
Yeah, she's been so impressive. That's one of three interviews that she's done. That was after the first round of the 1500. She was then asked yesterday after the semi-final about the comments made by a teammate of hers, Craig Engels, who's in the 1500 semis for the men. He basically said Jenny's tarnishing everyone's reputation. And again, respect to Cathal, because he said, sorry, Craig, who's tarnishing the reputation? Is it not Salazar?
Yeah.
By doing what he's done? He's the one who's tarnishing reputations, not Jenny Simpson for voicing her opinions. And then she subsequently has also said that she thinks that now that the cloud has become a conviction, because she alludes to this cloud that's been over these athletes for a long time, and that's absolutely true. And the thing she says at the end there is that anyone who knows anything about this wouldn't be shocked. Again, it's like Willis. The athletes know. They know. And they're not reacting like this because of carnitine and a testosterone experiment. There's much more. They know it. And she's now saying that they should investigate those other athletes. And I hope that that's what's happened from this. And then just a last point on that was a mate of mine sent me a quote, Barney Rene, from the Guardian, put a sort of tongue-in-cheek quote, says what tweet, "What seems really admirable to me is that none of Salazar's star athletes have seemed cross or denounced him for trashing their own entirely unrelated achievements or reputations. Great restraint." Because imagine you're clean and you've worked for 10 years, you've picked up a couple of Olympic medals, and all you've ever done is blood, sweat, and tears. Not blood, just sweat and tears. No one else's blood. And maybe vitamins. And now this happens. Everyone who's ever been coached by Salazar is now under more of a cloud than ever before.
Yeah,
I would be furious. I'd be absolutely pissed off. Yet nobody has come out and said, hang on, this is ridiculous. I am furious with Salazar. How could you do this to me?
Yeah.
What's going on there? Is that omerta, you know, the classic code of silence that everyone obeys?
That's the cycling sort of code of silence they talk about a lot, isn't it?
It's the mafia code of silence then used in cycling. And is that the same thing?
Yeah.
Is it just loyalty?
Yeah.
Is it some sort of weird Stockholm syndrome where you sympathize with your captor or your... I don't know. I suspect that's probably quite complex. I'm not going to judge Craig Engels for saying I trust Alberto and so on, because they're invested. But they're also massively compromised by their choices.
And in a way, he's kind of overuse the analogy, but he's a kind of a godfather in American athletics, purely because he was a multiple three-time New York Marathon champion 3 years in a row. I think it was 1980 to 82. And he gained this notoriety as this like guy that could take on the East Africans. He won the Comrades Marathon in South Africa here in 1994 after going through lots of different dips. He's got this aura around him that he was one of the best in the world. Therefore, he should be the right person to coach the best American athlete. So you can understand this loyalty to him because he was one of the few to stand up against this East African revolution in running.
Yeah, and I was chatting with David Epstein, who was one of the journalists who first broke the story. So just for people who don't know the timeline, the rumors and the questions and the doubts over Salazar have circulated for years, ever since he even began the Nike Oregon project. Mary Slaney failed a testosterone test and he was coaching her.
That's right.
So the
it was it early goes 94, way back. Right? 94, 95.
Yeah, that's right. And now in this USADA report, by the way, Salazar's admitted that he was using testosterone in 1991 while he was still active. So you can see how far back this goes. But from the perspective of what we know now, 2015 was the watershed, because a group of journalists, Mark Daly from the BBC, David Epstein was one of them, they got wind of whistleblowers. Classic anti-doping or doping exposure comes from whistleblowers. Steve Magness was the assistant coach with Salazar in Oregon, when up at NOP. And he was deeply uncomfortable having watched the men's 10,000 in 2012. Farah wins it, Rupp is second. And he says, this just doesn't sit with me. He called it one of the most disheartening days of his life.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, contacted USADA, and that kind of starts the process. And over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, more and more people are contacted. There's an investigation going on that we didn't know about. 2015, the media writes this, David Epstein's one of them. So that's to preface his involvement. And he was saying to me that most people don't appreciate that Salazar is still one of the biggest names and most recognized faces and names in U.S. track and field. Yeah. Second only, in his words, to Carl Lewis. And that's why it is like the Lance Armstrong thing, because it's one of the biggest names you can possibly go down. And to get a 4-year ban, that's a massive deal. Because getting these things over the line is not easy. It's gone through basically the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency's investigation and then to arbitration, because they charged him in 2017. And then for the next 2 years, there are a series of hearings and interviews. And eventually you hit with the most severe ban you can get, 4 years for a first offense.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Can we talk a little bit about what the transgressions are, the list of allegations, because I think it's important to kind of break each of those down and to kind of get an idea that the defense of what he's talking about, sometimes it feels like it can hold some water, but in reality, if you dig a little bit deeper down, that's why you can understand why some athletes are supporting him and most are going, well, thank goodness this has been caught out now. So let's just delve a little bit deeper into what those allegations are.
Yeah, and this is where now you start saying, okay, if you're a person who wants to stick purely to the facts, then this is an anticlimax. And Scott Faubel is a marathon runner from the US. And again, for listeners, go and look up his Twitter, because he posted some thoughts on this. And he used the analogy, it feels like Al Capone for tax evasion, when you think that there's a lot more to it. The three charges that he's eventually found guilty of are, number one, administering a prohibited method. And specifically there, he was giving, well, they didn't manage to pin it on he was giving athletes, but he was testing out the infusions of carnitine. Carnitine is not banned itself. It's a supplement. You can go into the pharmacy, you can get it, and you can take it. It's advertised as helping with weight loss and endurance because carnitine is a molecule that helps your body use fat better.
Okay.
The problem is, and there's some research on this, I was just looking at it this morning, is they found that it's not effective as a supplement because it just doesn't get the levels high enough in the body. So Salazar, from the reports, was impatient and he wanted a boost in this stuff. So he said, right, I'm going to inject it. But then you're only allowed 50 mils every 6 hours, not enough. So he said, forget it, I'm going a liter over 4 hours. And then later on, he tried a liter within 1 hour, allegedly. And this was all on Magnus. So this comes a lot from Steve Magnus's testimony. So that's using a legal substance, but using a prohibited method. Guilty.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Makes sense, yeah. So in other words, anybody can take that medication, but if you start using it in excess, it's then seen as a prohibited substance.
In excess via this method.
Okay.
Because normally you would take it as a pill. But it's the infusion beyond 50 mils every 6 hours. And they were, I mean, if you, Magnus is saying a liter within an hour, it's like, that's straight to the top floor, right?
Yeah.
So that's, and one interesting thing about that is that they were trying this stuff out. And Magnus,
so the benefit of that would be?
Improved endurance. So, and potentially weight loss, but there's an account that Steve Magnus has told where he gets this infusion and he goes out and running and he calls the results almost unbelievable. And then, interestingly enough, Salazar emails one Lance Armstrong and says, Lance, you got to see this. It's amazing. So there was this connection. I mean, it's all linked. They're all linked through Nike, obviously. So that's Lance's guest appearance in this case, which is quite funny because it's funny because everyone's always like, you think about doping, Lance is the fall guy. And sure enough, he's making a cameo unwittingly in this one. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
So that was the problem there. The second charge was tampering with the doping process, which is kind of linked to the first. So we've spoken about the carnitine. Salazar knew that what he was doing was not legal, but he was telling the athletes not to worry, I've cleared this with USADA, and he hadn't. So effectively, he was misleading his athletes, and that's treated as a charge of tampering with the doping process.
How would he have done that, potentially?
Well, the athletes were saying, like, what is this legit? Are we okay to do this? And he's saying, no, absolutely, it's fine, because he just wants them to comply and go along with it. So he's misleading them about anti-doping regulation and permissions and so forth. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then the third one, which is a really interesting one, and that's what Craig Engels referred to in his interview in Doha, is he was found guilty of trafficking testosterone, basically using testosterone and administering it off-label for illegal uses. And the story here, I'll give you Salazar's version of it first, is that they were very paranoid that someone was going to sabotage their athletes by rubbing testosterone into them and causing them to fail a test. Now, that's not without precedent because Justin Gatlin maintains that his testosterone doping positive was the result of a masseur rubbing testosterone into his legs during a massage.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2009, there's a story about Galen Rupp feels this hand and it's got some sort of gel stuff on it and he's really paranoid. It turns out to be the same dude as Gatlin alleges. So this is where this thing goes. Yeah,
there's a guy walking around with testosterone in his hands then.
It's like a Netflix thing. Yeah.
It's a great story.
And so they say, okay, we're really worried about this. And so Salazar comes up to working together with Dr. Jeffrey Brown, who's the co-accused, co-guilty with him now eventually, they come up with this plan to run an experiment where they're going to test various amounts of testosterone on Salazar's sons. So they devised this protocol, like this is now backyard science, basically, where they're going to give Salazar's sons a couple of dollops of cream. They're going to make him run 20 minutes in hot conditions. They're going to test him. Did he fail the test? Yes or no? So they basically, and then we're going to try it with three. Then we're going to try it with four. Should we go to six? And they run a series of experiments. I mean, he plays basketball the one day. I was reading in the report. And they are communicating, and this is where the Nike CEO gets named, because he receives an email from this doctor saying, listen, we've tried it with three. The value in the doping control was this, so we're looking good. It doesn't trigger it, and so on. So basically, they're doing this, allegedly, to put their minds at ease that no one can sabotage them. in the event that they fail a test in the future, they're going to say, oh, it was sabotage.
Okay.
Now, that, yeah, I find that preposterous. I mean, there are so many other ways a paranoid person would act to...
Well, for instance, is it possible to get positive testosterone test, as Gatlin suggests, by massaging that into your legs?
I mean, yeah, I'm sure it is.
Is that feasible?
Well, that's how you take testosterone sometimes.
So it's one of those biofeasible things.
One of the methods of using testosterone as a drug is to take it as a cream and rub it in. So, yes, I don't know how much it takes. That's what they were asking.
Yeah.
USADA's contention is obvious. They're saying, hang on, you're saying this is for sabotage, but this could just as easily be you guys running tests to see how much you can get away with and then using it for doping. And I want to make the point, it could be both.
Yeah.
It could be both, right? Because you're going to find both things out.
But there was some suggestion that that is why he was doing it, is because they were trying to push the limits of legality.
Yeah, he's always on the edge. You know, like once you cross over into the gray, you want to get as close to the black as you possibly can. But how do you know when you're in the black?
Yeah.
Unless you test it. And so he's testing it on his son. This is USADA's argument. He's testing it on his sons because they, who cares? They're not going to get him banned. Well, they did. But they're not going to be banned in competition.
Yeah.
And he wants to work out how far he can go.
Yeah.
And so that eventually they find him guilty of running those experiments without the permission of USADA. I mean, there's no ethical – I mean, ethics doesn't even factor into it. They just do what it takes. And so those are the three things that he eventually gets the four-year ban for. What's interesting, and I find it odd and David has found it odd, we were discussing it, is in the actual decision, they make this argument that he's acted in the best interest of the athletes, that he's tried really hard to remain within the rules and so forth, but then it still hits him with 4 years.
Yeah.
So the wording of the decision and the outcome of the decision for me don't align, but I think people must understand that this is arbitration.
Yeah.
And arbitration by its nature seeks to find conciliation or reconciliation, conciliatory findings. I was involved in arbitration at the beginning of the year because of the Caster Semenya thing, and I was amazed at how civil it was.
Yeah.
It's not adversarial. I mean, ours ended up being, because it's literally about someone's identity. Are you a man or a woman? It's a big deal.
Yeah.
But it's quite a civil, open discussion platform where all they're trying to actually do is find the truth and then reach some sort of compromise.
Yeah.
And so I think the language reflects that. But the point I'm left with is that USADA started in 2015 and for 2 years did an investigation, and they came up with a 269-page report that concluded the same things as this panel.
Have you read it all?
No.
Just the salient points.
I skipped the legal stuff about jurisdiction and jurisprudence, and I was like, oh, that's my head. And now this American Arbitration Association has done the same thing over 2 years and reached the same conclusions. And so Tygart said that Salazar prioritizes performance well beyond the health of his athletes. And there's other examples of it. And now I think really all that remains is to see whether anyone takes this baton and runs with it. Because if they do, there's a lot more. You know, the initial media reports included the thyroid stuff. They included the precision of massive doses of vitamin D that could potentially cause cancer. Calcitonin. Again, none of this illegal, but it's all part of this medicalization of sport and this use of prescription drugs that I think is probably quite harmful.
Let's just take a slight step back and look at the history of the Nike Oregon Project. Of course, it was something that started in 2001 when Salazar was approached by Nike to do this. And the idea was that they were basically going to produce American athletes that were going to be competitive with the East Africans. That was the premise of it. And I know that initially that the results weren't coming through as much as I think the Nike Oregon Project and particularly Salazar were necessarily happy with, and kind of suggests why they were pushing the limits on these things. But we saw an amazing performance from Mo Farah and Galen Rupp, both athletes, with Alberto Salazar winning the 10,000 in London in 2012. And it showed that that he was producing the results. So there was quite a lot of pressure on him to potentially do something that I suppose physiologically almost seems impossible, because you're taking on sort of super athletes from East Africa and trying to mold them into something just by training methods. So there was probably that real pressure to perform, and a commercial pressure as well of coming from Nike.
I mean, would have been.
It's hypothesis, I admit. But
it's a classic story, and it's not unique to sport. Think about business. Why do businesses do corrupt things? White collar crime and fraudulent accounting is because someone is on the hook to produce profits and they can't. And then they get pressurized from the top and they say, well, by any means necessary, I have to deliver the goals that have been set for me. And if you don't create a culture of absolutely zero tolerance towards cheating or dishonesty or anything that lacks integrity, then you get this, in my opinion, like there's a creep of standards.
Yeah.
And you're doing things that you think are innovative. You're using underwater treadmills and anti-gravity treadmills and altitude tents, all these things that are legal. And most people would say, wow, look at this innovative environment. But then that stuff becomes a little bit more malicious and it starts to become a little bit more gray. And eventually you start looking over the precipice into the black. And then you discover that the athletes you're racing against might be doping, right? This is the story of Lance Armstrong, not to invoke the same guy's name. This is the story of countless cyclists who've discovered this in that sport. This is probably the story of many of the Kenyan runners who've doped, is that they get to a point where they've got to make a choice. Mm. I dope, I follow the advice of my coach or my doctor, or I quit. And what are they quitting for? Like, what life? So I think it's a classic pattern, if that's what's happened here. Mm. And yeah, he's always been known as innovative. Mm. But he's also always been known for being pretty sketchy and by any means necessary. 1999, he gave a talk, I think it was at Duke, and he said it's impossible to be in the top five unless you use EPO. Now, that was arguably the case then. Skeptics would say it's still the case now, but the difference is that between then and now, they developed a test for EPO. So in theory, the picture should be better. But there was this, I think in general in sport, there's a belief that you've got to do as much as you can. Yeah. Otherwise, you'll be left behind. And where do you draw the line on as much as you can? Because the moment you do, it's not as much as you can.
So you alluded to the fact that this is maybe the start of something going forward. Like, are you suggesting then that this is just the tip of an iceberg in terms of athletics around the world or around American athletics? I mean, when you say, you talked a little bit about when we're building up to this podcast around how the media handled this situation, is that media people within the sport of athletics have come out now saying, well, yeah, we knew this was coming. So why didn't anybody bring it up until 2015 when people outside of the media within athletics kind of brought it up? What is potentially going to happen now in the sport?
I think it depends on the appetite of the media to go further. So for instance, in the British media, their angle on this, well, their two angles on this have been, how does it affect Mo Farah? And how does it affect UK athletics? Because UK athletics used Salazar as a consultant, and he was really the coach who delivered them their golden egg.
Yeah,
Farah won two doubles at the Olympics, the 5 and 10 twice, under Salazar's coaching, having been before that a good to middling athlete. So the transformation of Farah has always been suspicious. And once Salazar was named as being in the media reports of 2015, UK athletics said, we have to investigate this. Magnus, the aforementioned whistleblower, has said that they called him up for 45 minutes and did what was really just a cursory interview.
Yeah.
And then they approved Salazar's continued coaching of Farah for 2 years longer. It was only in 2017 that Farah left Salazar. So point is that they have some serious questions to answer. There's a quote by the head of the athletics saying, Salazar's a genius. We absolutely will stay working with the guy. Well, history has made those words look unbelievably reckless.
And he was at one point sort of IAAF coach of the year after 2012.
Yeah, he would have been.
He was lauded around the world as the most groundbreaking coach in the sport.
Massively. Yeah. Though, again, I think many people always had questions, but there are clouds. So you can't withhold awards based on suspicion. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, people in the sport knew, but fine. But 2015, they knew details. And then they had to make a choice. They had to say, is Steve Magnus lying? Is Cara Gaucher? Is Adam Gaucher lying? Is Fleshman lying? Is Ritzenheim lying? I mean, how many people had to lie for that thing to be false? Like, it's ridiculous that all of them made it up. But so at that point, people had to make a call. And some people chose to double down. He's a genius. They stayed with him for another few years. And now all of a sudden, and that's why this is, it's not funny, but people are now saying, oh, now we know this. We've known this all along. But people made a call, despite knowing this, to stick with it. Because
this polarizing effect that he's had on this discussion is listening to the accusations against him, you can understand why there was some and I hesitate to say this, some justification for what he was doing. So if he's pushing the limits on testosterone with non-athletes, you know, he could say, okay, well, that's wrong. Morally, it's wrong. We found out now that obviously from a legal standpoint in terms of IAAF and USADA, it's wrong. But there is that sort of gray area with him trying to just be better and not, you know, doing the traditional steroids and EPO. He was literally doing stuff that maybe was on that line, which kind of goes against what goes with what a lot of the athletes are saying. It was, he just overstepped the mark. I think Paul Radcliffe's on record as saying he overstepped the mark, which is what I think a lot of athletes feel about this.
Yeah, the official panel decision uses language not exactly like that. I'll see if I can find the wording, but it's very similar to overstep the mark. He erred on the side of some. I forget exactly. I'll see if I can find it in a moment. But that, and you know, when we did our drugs in sport podcast, and in fact before that, I think no, after that we'd done a cheating in sport podcast. And it's funny because you keep coming back to where's the gray area. And I see the world in a bit more black and white. But I've started to realize actually that you are onto, because fundamental, the thing that this all revolves around is what's cheating. I mean, that's what it is. And I reckon if you're an athlete and you hire the coach, there's almost an expectation that this coach is going to do with me what it takes for me to win. But again, that immediately puts me in the gray areas. Yeah. But I'm also trusting that I've got some sort of moral compass to say, where do I want to stop? But it's not a legal compass.
Yeah.
It's a moral one. Now, again, listeners, go and find Cheating in Sport podcast and our Drugs in Sport podcast, because the two of those is fundamentally what I'm about to talk about now, is the current doping practice in sport is all about prescription drugs and medication. In a sense, it always has been, because EPO is a prescription drug. It wasn't made for athletics. It was made to treat people with renal failure. Testosterone was made for people who have hypogonadism and low testosterone.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
So every drug, in a sense, is a prescription drug. But I think where we are now in 2019 is the testing has become sophisticated enough to catch the basic stuff. And so the athletes and their coaches and the doctors have adapted. To quote an anti-doping expert called Michael Ashenden, anti-doping shed its skin and it took on a new guise. And that new guise is prescription drugs. So the use of thyroid hormone for people who don't need it, the use of asthma meds for people who don't need it, the use of testosterone. Salazar tried to get an exemption to use testosterone on the basis of having low levels himself. So I think cortisone for athletes who don't need it. Get bronchitis so that you can get this powerful drug.
Yeah.
So that's where it is. But again, none of that stuff's banned. So again, talking to some journalists over the last 5 or 6 years, they keep coming back to this point, like, but he's not doing anything illegal, but it's hugely unethical. It's actually illegal in society for a coach to be giving athletes medical drugs. That's a violation of prescription medication law, but not anti-doping regulations. So yes, but for me, it still sounds a lot like when asked about it, if you can't tell people, then you know it's wrong. Yeah. So when they asked Salazar about thyroid hormone and cortisone and all that sort of stuff, and he keeps saying, no, we don't use any of that. Well, why are you denying it?
Yeah.
Because you know. You just know fundamentally that this is not right.
Which is what Simpson is saying, that why would any athlete go there knowing what the reputation of Salazar was? But I guess, I mean, I'm not trying to labor the point, but to some extent there is this idea that if running in athletics is your only mean of income and your only way of progressing in life, and you see that a guy like Salazar is IAAF Coach of the Year, producing results like Gannon Rupp and Mo Farah, you know, you're going to almost take a risk. I would take a risk if I thought that if it's not absolute value, this guy's going to turn me into somebody who can really be a superstar athlete, and I could win Olympic gold because I'm now in 10th place. it must be an extremely tempting thing for athletes to think about.
Must be hugely tempting. And I've also said, I'm glad I didn't have the talent, because talent puts you in a position of having to choose. And I'm lucky I never had to make the choice. Same thing. But like the best athletes at some point are faced with that choice. And okay, I'm not going to begrudge the person going there. But I think Jenny Simpson's right, is when there's that much around it, it's just, and he's not, the problem is you're falling prey to marketing a little bit there, because they're not all that, you know. There are so many good, honest people in sport, I think, that I don't think you have to go there. And I completely understand. I cannot now watch athletes, and I suppose we'll get on to the good news to end off about Doha. Well, yeah. It's not even good news anymore, really. But we'll get on to some performances. But when you see an amazing performance, who's her coach? Salazar. Okay, that's not so cool.
Yeah.
I mean, again, last time of a hat tip for Cahill Dennehy. He says, truth is, the vast majority of athletes, coaches, and agents had long known what Salazar was up to and had waited for this day. A cynical coach who was long lauded as a genius was found to be as flawed as everyone believed. The fairy tale Salazar told us was just that. He won't be missed. In an earlier paragraph, he says, in Doha this week, there's been much anger, but also celebration. Now, when your reputation is that toxic, Jenny Simpson is right, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I cannot understand why athletes do not come out and say, I am absolutely livid, pissed off at my reputation being tarnished because this guy was stuffing around with testosterone and carnitine and doing all these illegal things. Why don't they? It's just, and again, tip of the iceberg, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a big thank you to those that are following us on YouTube at the moment. We're trying out a new system today. So we got a couple of comments from people talking specifically about the Kenenisa Bekele run in Berlin. Matt Kemp saying Formula One of marathon running. I suppose it's quite a good comment, because I think if you think about all the different technological advantages in Formula One, it all comes down to the car. So at what point does running just come down to the shoe? I suppose that's a controversial topic.
Well, but, so on that, the thing there is, if the difference between the top 10 is 1.5% and the difference made by the shoe is 1.6%, then the result has no integrity.
Yeah.
Because 10th to 1st could be determined by something other than the runner.
Yeah.
And that is the problem.
And then a couple of comments, Jordan Mansfield saying the next generation doctors will be hard to expose. And I suppose that's the big danger. And I think that's one of the things that I guess media and people like ourselves and yourself in the sports science space, it is one of the biggest jobs going forward in the sport of athletics, is that everything is going to become more and more sophisticated as we go, because it's not going to be something that is going to get any easier to detect. Athletes are always going to cheat, as we've discussed on our cheating podcast. It's always something that people are going to be wanting to do.
Yeah, so we've been talking Salazar all the time. The doctor who prescribed all this stuff. So for me, behind the three things we listed is what he was guilty of. I think a bigger issue is that he had a corrupt doctor who was willing to do these things also. And that Dr. Brown's not the only one. In the ProPublica Epstein reporting and so forth, they name another one who is now no longer alive, but was also responsible. Salazar would send them to him and send his athletes to these doctors and say, don't ask questions. Just take what he gives you and everything will be fine.
Yeah.
And so there was this very loose medical process. And so banning the doctor, and presumably the US Medical Association will act on this also, and I guess the doctor runs the risk of losing a license. That's a very powerful message. So I think it would hopefully make some doctors think twice about doing it, because think about how much they've got to lose their license.
Yeah.
And I think that this is very good, because every time an athlete gets done in court, people say, but where did he get the drugs?
Yeah.
Who's facilitating this? What about the entourage, the support staff? Who's enabling doping? And so now we get that. And one of the most disingenuous takes, for a few different reasons, was Paula Radcliffe, who in an interview absolutely face planted it on the motives of USADA. She tried to, go and watch it. I can't even do it justice. But then in subsequent tweets, she said that she's frustrated and disappointed that they're spending all this time and resources going after the coach. They should go after the athletes. Well, no. Every time an athlete gets done, you go for the coach. Now the coach gets done, you say, no, go for the athletes. Which is it? It's got to be one or the other. Or maybe it should be. No, it doesn't have to be one or the other. It should be both. And this is this is a big breakthrough because I think it sends a good message. And it's celebrated. It shouldn't be condemned.
Yeah. Right, so we've discussed the good and the bad of athletics. Let's wrap up the podcast today with a little bit of a look at the World Athletics Championships. We did a preview to the World Athletics Championships just over a week ago, talking a little bit about some of the advancements and particularly around the heat issue, that it was a big talking point. And we hoped that the heat was going to be the only talking point at the World Athletics Championships. And as Ross prophetically said, it hasn't been the talking point. I suspect that Alberto Salazar has been that. But the Heat, they've got the air conditioning system in the stadium, which seems to have made a difference from what I've read online. They've reduced the temperatures down a bit. All the events have been later, but probably the key event has always been the marathons. And so far, now we know we've got the men's marathon still coming up, but the women's marathon, a lot of criticism about the Heat and a lot of criticism aimed at the IAAF and the organisers. Not that the organizers have got anything to do with the heat, but the IAAF awarding an event like the Olympics, like the World Championships to Doha, and saying that heat is just unfair for athletes. But is it really? I mean, is it not just live with the circumstances?
Yeah, a little bit. I saw much of the feedback. People were saying it's inhumane and so forth and shouldn't ever be done again and no one considers the athletes. And I suppose when you look at it, they had 40 finishes. And 69, I think, entrants. One didn't start, made the call before to say this is maybe they were injured. And then 41% of the field dropped out. Now, that's obviously not a good look, but you can understand why. If you're coming 15th after 10K and you've already lost a minute to the leaders, what are you running for? You're going to run a 2:48 to come 20th? No.
Yeah.
So, but I also like the fact that it throws a new challenge, you know? I think you see these optimized conditions all the time for marathons, perfect races, perfectly flat courses, throw a set of pacemakers in there and just make everything exactly how they need it to be. But actually, it's meant to be a test.
Yeah.
And it's meant to be about how well you manage your body. That's what it is. So if you are the one athlete who's intelligent enough to prepare for it, to start off conservatively, to do the pre-cooling stuff that we have seen athletes do, to manage your pace in the first 15 to 25 kilometers and come through strongly and get a bronze medal, then good for you.
Yeah.
If you're not, and you go off and try and run a 2:28 on a 2:36 day, then you deserve to bail at 30Ks, in my opinion. So yeah. I don't think it's that bad, to be honest with you. I mean, ideally, you don't want to see athletes collapsing and so forth in these races. And
potentially, you get those athletes that are not necessarily the fastest
exactly
winning the race, which exactly gives more people more chance, I suppose.
Because if you set it up as a perfect course on a cool day and you have six athletes who can run 2:24 or faster, that athlete who can run 2:31 has no chance of a medal. Mm. None. But if you set it up on a warm day...
Athletes from Norway.
Yeah. Whereas if you set it up in a way that actually those 2:24 people are going to run 2:36, that 2:31 has a chance because if they do everything that it takes in the 6 months before. So I look at this Doha race and the men's marathons this weekend and I think we'll see the same thing. And I'd be saying if I'm a 2:31, 2:32 athlete woman on the women's side, I'm looking at Tokyo and saying here's a real chance because if I can be the person least affected, I'm going to potentially get an Olympic medal. And what do I need to do to do that? I think it adds a layer of intrigue, you know?
Yeah.
I get that you don't want it all the time. But for me, some of the most exciting marathons have been these ones that are really affected. And they're unpredictable as a result. On the track, I think the heat hasn't been an issue. Because you saw a 30:17 from Hassan, saw a 12:58 win the men's five. That's not happening at 35 degrees Celsius. So the heat there has been fine. But
so the air conditioning system has worked?
It's certainly done enough like to make legitimate races. Yeah, it doesn't seem to have been a problem. But again,
And this isn't really a science question, but I guess the biggest controversy around the actual event itself has been the crowd support.
Yeah.
And I never can quite understand this, but particularly on the men's 100-meter final, which I think was last Sunday, before there was a track event, I think it was a distance event, you'll probably know which one it was, but there was a good crowd for that. But as soon as the 100 meters started, the crowd left. Mm. And ironically, if you go to any World Championships and Olympic Games, it's always the biggest crowd for the 100 meters. It's the most glamorous event on the whole week of athletics. I don't even I'm trying to even guess why would everybody leave before the 100-meter final.
Is it logistics? Because yeah. I've noticed the same thing. By the time they crossed the finish line, I mean, Coleman took 9.76 seconds, whatever. Within 9.76 seconds of the race finishing, everyone was heading for the exits. So they do these victory laps and they're waving at empty seats. We spoke in our preview about how athletics is fighting for legitimacy and relevance and popularity. And then you see that.
Seb Coe, who heads up the IAAF, has come out in defense of the decision because he's saying that as much as the criticism, and he's been had a go at the media about this, and particularly the BBC, talking about the low crowd, saying that if you're going to develop the sport of athletics, you need to be able to take it to different regions. And yes, the crowds might be not big here, but it's taking the sport to another part of the world, and hopefully that will grow it in the long term.
If Qatar has even a 2% growth in interest in athletics after this, I'll be extremely surprised. The reason that the distance race, so to come back to that, that was the women's 10,000 was just before the men's 100. And every single distance race so far has been the loudest in the stadium. And I think it's because the population of Qatar is made up of a lot of immigrant workers from countries like Kenya, Ethiopia, and so on. And so there's this, if you watch it now, the listeners over the next few days, you'll see at where the 1500 starts. So that's 100 meters into the lap on that first bend. There's a section there that looks like it's basically been occupied by the distance running fans.
Yeah.
And you see Ethiopian flags, Qatari flags, Kenyan flags, and the biggest cheers are coming from there. And I reckon they come to watch those races and then they leave. Now, the reason I bring that up is because they are now the most popular events at these World Champs, the distance events.
Yes.
And that's the one thing the IAAF took out of the program of Diamond Leagues. So,
and maybe they should run a 5,000 then for the Diamond League just in Qatar, and they have the Qatar event as the only event with the 5,000.
I think they've got to think about that. Like you got to know your audience. So if you go to Eugene and you have that meet there, that's a distance running mecca. That meeting should have a 15, a 5, and a 10. It's Priestland, you know, Prefontaine.
Yeah.
The Rabat Diamond League in Morocco is a distance mecca. Qatar should be a distance one, and then do one or two in Europe. And then let the Europeans watch the... They should have a multi-sport. I mean, they have the decathlon yesterday was really good. The heptathlon was a little bit one-sided, but the decathlon came down to 3 medals up for grabs in the final race.
Yeah.
So there's, I think they could layer it in a more intelligent way than saying the 5,000 is boring. The best event of Doha so far has been the 5,000 in terms of entertainment.
Just other highlights?
Well,
what stuck out for you so far?
Hassan's 10,000 was astonishing. She ran the last 1,500 in 3:59,
yeah,
which is the 11th fastest 1,500 of the year. At the back end of a 10,000 that ended up being a 30:17, at the back end of that was a 5,000 in 14:43. It's insane. She could win the 5,000 with the second half of a 10.
Yeah.
She's not in the 5. She's running the 15. So yeah, that is the athlete who will go down as the most dominant of these world champs. I'd be hugely surprised if she loses the 15.
But of course, do we need to say who her coach is?
Exactly. So we
and this is the problem. I mean, we talk about that performance and how good it's been, and now all of a sudden there's a shadow hanging over her. And if that performance is legitimate, even if it is legitimate, and we hope it is, it's tainted because of these allegations. People are going to start looking and saying, well, is it true?
Exactly. I mean, even before that, because this was on Saturday, I guess. The report comes out and the ban is on Wednesday. So, okay, the dust has settled on that performance. But even watching it, you're like, oh, man, is this legit? Can I trust what I'm seeing here? 3:59 at the end of a 10,000? It's unbelievable. It's the equivalent, by the way, of running a 3:31 for a man at the end of a 10K. Yeah. And I went back in history and I tried to find some examples. It's more difficult than you'd think, but in 2017, the last 1500 of a 5K was 3:43.
Yeah.
So she's so much faster than anyone that's closed these races. And you could get technical and say she's running her half marathon pace up to 5K and then it gets quicker. And so it's obviously not impossible because someone did it. But and then of course now everyone's saying she hasn't given an interview since.
Yeah.
Every time in the mixed zone after a race, straight past them, because what's the first question they're going to ask?
Yeah.
So that's the problem. And again, if I'm Hassan, I would stop at that mic and I would say, you know what? Like, I joined after this investigation. I'm only been there for 2 years. I am so pissed off at Alberto Salazar right now, and I hope he never comes back to the sport. That would be, for me, the response that I'd say, good for you, Stephen.
Yeah.
But she's not giving it.
Yeah. Other highlights, of course, the men's 100 meters, we've just touched on it. Christian Coleman dominating, as you predicted he would, but Justin Gatlin, 37 years old, getting the silver medal. A controversial character, but nevertheless, a good story. I mean, we talked about 37-year-olds doing well this year.
He delivered it in the final, like, I think maybe better than certainly I expected. He only squeaked into that final, actually. He nearly missed qualification. And I predicted that he'd struggle to medal, but then he raised it when it mattered. You know, maybe that's experience.
And we both had a side bet on Akani Simbini, the South African, who I said might get a silver, and you said bronze, and he ended up being in fourth. So
yeah,
a little bit disappointing from him, but nevertheless, quite a consistent performance.
Yeah, because I feel like it was a soft 100. I looked at the time. Coleman's time was quick, but second and third were not lights out fast, you know, so it felt like a softer year than in the past. So that was a medal that he might regret not winning. The women's 100 was not soft. I mean, Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce in 10.70 was unreal. The semifinal was 10.8, is crazy. Again, a little bit one-sided. So not a great race, but an unbelievable performance. The women's 400 last night was won in the third fastest time in history. I don't know if you saw that, by NASA from Bahrain, which was a big surprise. She beat Miller Weibo. So that was eye-opening. But for me, the distance events have been the most fun.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the IAAF solution to the Diamond League issue should have been to not get rid of the five, but just get rid of the pacemakers.
Because, make it a race.
Yeah, because it's so intriguing when you actually give people the responsibility of taking it on. Because the Diamond League... Let's be clear. I love distance running, but the Diamond League 5Ks are dull.
Yeah.
Because for three laps, they run in single file behind a pace setter, 3Ks. Then for the 4th K, everyone slows down and jogs and saves themselves for the finish. And then the last 600 meters is a furious sprint, and it's exciting. It's boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
This 5K in Doha was interesting because you had Ingebrigtsen, who's the 1,500-meter guy. And if it's slow for the first 3Ks, he's basically running his 1,500.
He was fantastic to watch, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he was aggressive, and so that made it. But the Ethiopians knew that he was there, so they took it out hard in the beginning, and you could see Berega and Bekele and Idris were pushing because they were aware of the threat. So there's all this intrigue going on, and then Ingebrigtsen comes to the party, and he pushes, and it was terrific. It was such a good race.
And that's why I think if there's a way to end off on a positive note in this podcast, that is why Olympic Games and World Championships, for me, feel like the most legitimate form of the sport, because there is no pace setting. It's literally like the best athlete on the day will win. It's about competition, and that's what's important. And I think if we're watching the World Athletics Championships, and I think let's cast our minds slightly forward to where we are in Tokyo next year. Celebrate these championships. Celebrate the Olympic Games, because these are the one element of the sport which is not defined by pace setting or kind of a commercial derivative.
Yeah, that's what I agree. Even marathons we're getting now. Berlin obviously kicked off the fall marathon season. We'll have Chicago next and New York. And then obviously in amongst all that, we've got this contrived sub-2 attempt, which I'm interested to see how it goes as an experiment, but I'm not interested in it as an athletic achievement, because A, I think it's massively tarnished by the shoes and all the other gimmicks that they throw at it. And so I don't think it says much about human performance. But you know, like the race that I'm going to miss it because I fly back from Japan on the day that it's happening is the New York Marathon, because they never have a pace setter. And so they come into Central Park and it becomes a race, and there's hills and there's challenges and it's different. That's what I think the sport needs more of in order to survive. But someone along the line 20 years ago has decided that the stopwatch matters more than the contest.
Yeah.
And whoever that person is should be hung and quartered.
And to be honest with you, if you're watching a fast time, it makes no difference from a visual perspective whether somebody's running.
You can't tell.
2 seconds a kilometer quicker. You can't tell.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'd prefer to see a race.
Me too. So I think that I agree. The future of the sport is more of the kind of racing we've got in Doha. The distance races are tremendous. Yeah. I really enjoy them. The sprints also, because like they avoid each other during the year.
Yeah.
And then finally you get to see this is the contest. So there's always something there. But I hope that they're not going to reconsider the 5K thing, but there's a fix to it. They didn't need to get rid of it. They could have fixed it.
So a couple of comments from people on our YouTube live at the moment. And we do apologize. We didn't promote this massively ahead of time because we were trying some new tech. But a last comment from ALH359 saying, Co has to go. Maybe, Ross, we can kind of wrap up this podcast by giving our opinion on that. Seb Co, of course, a controversial character. He's had a tough time the last couple of years. Is he doing good for athletics at the moment, or is athletics not good under Seb Co's watch?
Yeah, so Matt Lawton is a writer with The Times now, and he ran a piece a week before the World Champs where he spoke about Co and how he's saved athletics and how it's been changed and so forth. And that article didn't age well in a week.
Yeah.
Let's just say from the South African perspective, Co would definitely not be welcome here because people here blame him for pushing Semenya out of the sport. That's another debate altogether. I understand why he took the position he did. I don't agree with how they do it, but still. I think when you look at empty seats and doping scandals around this World Championships, there are some serious questions have to be asked, you know. Earlier on, you asked me about where this goes next, and I got sidetracked in my answer. And I was saying that the English media have picked up two things. One is the Mo Farah angle. The other one is the UK athletics piece and what it means for the governance of athletics. And I guess this ties into that. The future will depend on whether they have an appetite to actually answer the questions.
Yeah.
Just today, there was an article by Matt Dickinson saying about the whoosh that you hear is Nike sweeping another scandal under the carpet. Okay, fine. Are you going to do anything? Like, who's going to pick it up and pursue it now? Because if they do, this will be the tip of the iceberg may yet expose the rest of the iceberg.
Yeah.
But who's got the appetite? So that's where I think it goes. But does Co go? I doubt. No. Why? No, he won't go. Because athletics will be flush with money thanks to Qatar dollars.
Yeah.
And they'll just ride it out, and the next one will be in Eugene. Yeah. It'll be well attended, and everyone will have forgotten about the scandals of Doha, I reckon.
Yeah. Professor Ross Tucker, thank you very much for your time today. We look forward to another couple of days of the World Athletics Championships. We'll be doing an interesting podcast, hopefully with Justin Gatlin next week, and we'll be able to give you some insight into what it's like to be at the very top end of sprinting. But for now, that is us. We'll speak to you next time.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.